Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Memory. Welcome back, listeners, to a brand new episode of The Natural Selection Presents. This week's episode is all about... Oh, what was it again? Oh, memory. I'm glad I wrote that down. But yeah, I suppose I should introduce the team. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hi.
And I am also Nick. Hello. So, Nick, do you want to tell the listeners who we are?
Surely, Nick. We're The Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who wants to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each week we gather and wax lyrical about the natural world. In the first section of our podcast, we talk about nature news and interesting research from the past week. And in the second section, we talk about a different theme and how it relates to the flora and fauna around the world. This week's theme is memory.
Thanks, Nick. How are you two? Have you had any exciting nature interactions in the past 7 days?
Oh, yeah, and I wrote it down. I wanted to remember for the podcast, so I wrote it down in my notebook. I saw it's spring here, and it's migrating bird season, but they're going the other direction from the last time. But that doesn't mean that they're not in the sky. And I looked up one evening. It was almost like that time of night when the sun is set, but it's not quite dark yet, and you can see like the blue everywhere in the sky. And it was clear here in Berlin, which for February is kind of odd. But I looked up, and I saw the longest line of geese I've ever seen. It was like in a single line. It wasn't a V. It was like one geese after the other, like a little centipede, like a dragon, like all the way across half the sky. It was like crazy. There were like 100 geese in this line. It was super cool. So I watched them like go off into the distance. It really looked like a dragon. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Spirited Away, but the way it sort of moved like through the sky, it looked like how the dragon in that flies.
Oh, cool. That reminded me, I didn't get to see it myself, but I saw a picture on the Irish Times of this really impressive starling murmuration. Judging from Nick's reaction, I think he also saw it. But the photo is incredible because the shape that all the birds together are making looks like a bird.
It's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
I know, it's insanely amazing. So I didn't actually get to witness that myself, but it was in Ireland that someone took this photograph, and it's pretty cool. But my nature interaction, not usually something that we would consider in what we usually talk about, but this week I actually gave blood for the first time. And after I was finished giving blood, the man who was assisting with it had like my blood and was like, "This is your blood." So I had like an interaction where I was sort of saying to me like, "Oh, that's mine. Cool." So it was a thinking about my own internal workings and things that are part of my nature.
Wow. That's a moment where we, you know, the moment of self-recognition in the outside world. That's big. I like that. That's big.
Yeah. Just the way he said it, he kind of like had it in his hands. He was like, this is your blood. I was like, okay. I got that. Like I saw it coming out, but okay.
So those hundreds of geese flying in the same direction, do you think perhaps they smelled your blood?
They were? Wait, hold on. They were heading east.
To Naomi's house.
They're heading east, sadly. That's fun. Coming your way, Naomi. I don't know how long it takes 100 geese to fly from Berlin to London, but they might be getting there just about now.
Well, a really long time they went east.
Oh, cool beans. We should probably get into the news. I've got some news that I picked entirely for the benefit of Naomi. Because Naomi, her favourite thing to do is find new animals that are bioluminescent. And this week, listeners, I've already gone and beaten her to it. Because I found a paper about bioluminescence of the largest luminous vertebrate. And bigger is definitely better when it comes to bioluminescence. So, Naomi, I am winning now. But it's the kite-finned shark, Dalatus laica, Yeah, and another two as well. So this was some researchers from Belgium, actually. They did collaborate with people in New Zealand. They're from the Université Catholique du Levant. They were collected from Chatham Rise off New Zealand. And what they did is they actually documented luminescence of this species. And Dilatus lyca will be the largest bioluminescent vertebrate ever found. And this poses some interesting questions on what this bioluminescence is for, because they do notice it in deep sea sharks, which is what this is. It's often noticed as something called counterillumination, which is a type of camouflage. And what the counterillumination does is it stops any predators being able to tell what the outline of the animal is. So if it's illuminating itself, the predator doesn't understand what the outline is. It makes them harder to hunt. So it's a type of camouflage. But the thing is, like I said, this is a big shark. One, it's a shark. Two, it's big. It doesn't have any predators. It's 180 centimeters long. That's longer than me. And I know I'm not the tallest human, but that's pretty large, even for a shark. So there are no predators. So why on earth is it bioluminescent? It's quite interesting, right? So they've got a couple of theories. The first theory is it's actually a really slow swimming shark. It's assumed it possesses like high burst capability, but they're not positive. But it does eat things which have a higher cruise swimming speed. So they hypothesize that this counterillumination is a type of camouflage, but it stops their prey noticing they're being snuck up on. So yeah, basically it's a stealth method to get close to their prey. Alternatively, it could be a way to illuminate the ocean floor while hunting for prey in the deep ocean. They're not really sure, but those are their two main theories, because the previous theories on shark illumination, yeah, was a way to hide and things like that. So that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a glowing shark down there, well, you know how I feel about the ocean, listeners.
Negatively.
I would say negative. I don't think I think about the ocean and I'm like, that ocean out there. It's more like,
fair enough.
Strong emotions, no matter what sort. Strong emotions about the ocean.
That is really cool, though. I am very jealous that you beat me to it.
You have to be quicker next time. But yeah, luckily, Nick, you have the capabilities to express those emotions about the sea. You might not be the only person.
That is one way of leading into the news topic I have for you today. The research I was looking at was done by a team of authors in Spain, and they were looking at audition. And no, this is not when you stand up in front of a panel of judges and try to dance the can-can and get onto a TV show. This is audition in terms of being able to hear, or the capacity for hearing in different species. And it's different, of course, based on anatomy and morphology. And what they were looking at is the evolution of audition, not necessarily in humans, but in Neanderthals. Audition is studied very well in early hominins, but less is known about this sort of Neanderthal, what the hearing abilities of the Neanderthals were, despite us knowing quite a bit about their cranial morphology. So this project is looking at CT scans and auditory bioengineering to model sound power transmission through the outer and the middle ear to calculate the occupied bandwidth of audition in Neanderthals. So, okay, what does this mean? What I understand is that they're basically trying to understand, based on the structure of the ear bones in Neanderthals, what bandwidth of sound they can hear. And the reason that they're looking at this is because the bandwidth that species can hear is directly related to the efficiency of vocal communication in a species. So if they can hear a wider bandwidth, they can communicate more efficiently by using a wider band of frequencies and pitch in their vocal communication. That's my understanding. What they found is that the occupied bandwidth of audition in Neanderthals was greater than middle Pleistocene hominins, so early hominins, but it's similar to current humans. So what this implies is that already Neanderthals had evolved auditory capacities that allowed for a wide range of vocal communication that basically was as efficient as that taken up by modern human speech. So it's not implying that Neanderthals had as an efficient a system as modern human speech, but it's saying that their bodies had the ability to hear in that range, and maybe having that sort of preset could eventually have led to them being able to communicate as efficiently as we can.
I mean, that's amazing news, but I don't think I can understate how bitter I am that Simon Cowell didn't actually like my can-can, but, you know.
Wrong kind of audition, Nick.
But yeah, that's really cool. So it could have meant we could have had a chat with Neanderthals.
Could do. I could do. It makes me think about other interspecies relationships. Like when my cat tries to talk to me, she modulates her voice so that I can hear her. I think cats, when they speak to each other, they speak in a much higher frequency and that humans have trouble hearing. So when my cat wants my attention, she's good at code switching, if you will, into my species language and matching my auditory frequencies. Of course, I do the same for her.
Do you put on a German accent?
Sometimes I do talk to her in German.
Now, Naomi, you have some news about one of the weirdest organisms on Earth.
I do. I was very pleased when I stumbled across this piece of research because it fits so perfectly with today's theme. It was amazing. This piece of research was published in PNAS, and it was carried out by Kramer and Alim from the Max Planck Institute and the Technical University of Munich, respectively. So what they were looking at was memory in slime molds. So Nick mentioned a very weird organism. They're eukaryote, but they do some very unique things. They have characteristics that are a mix of a lot of different organisms, and they're very odd. They have some behaviors that are very different to many other organisms. But this piece of research was looking at memory, and memory is often associated with the brain and nervous systems, but these organisms don't have that. So how can they encode information about their environment? So they looked at the giant unicellular slime mold, Physarum polycephalum, and they looked at how it responded to its nutrient source. So this organism is made up of lots of different tubes of varying thicknesses, and they used theoretical models and data observing the slime mold, and they looked at how the memory is encoded. What they found was the nutrient source affects the thickness of the tubes. So it releases a softening agent that, depending on its location, affects how thick the tubes are. So the tubes that are closer to the softening agent get a wider diameter. So they get thicker, and then all the other tubes around it shrink. And basically then this acts as a sort of a highway, and that all these tubes that are thick allow information to get passed through it faster and transported through the whole organism faster. So this means that previous encounter was imprinted in this structure, in these network of tubes, and that will impact on the future decisions of how this organism goes and looks for food. So I'm not sure, hopefully that made sense, but in a nutshell, the way that the structure works, the past information about food affects how the organism is composed, and then this will affect what it'll do in the future and how it'll look for food and what direction it'll go for food in the future. So this is a really interesting insight looking at how these more simple animals, I say with air quotes, and look at and deal with complex environments and how they deal with memory.
Slime molds? If I didn't study mammals and if spiders didn't exist, slime molds would be all I could think about. They're so cool.
That is damning with faint praise.
No, I mean, yeah, my first love is mammals, Kasumi. Yeah. And spiders are like, God, look at them. They're so cool. But slime molds, I mean, they have, there's not a lot to compete with them.
But, you know, Nick, if I was like, hey, Nick, if Naomi and, you know, Dave didn't exist, you'd be my best friend.
You know what? Slime molds aren't going to do anything about it. So, spiders, on the other hand.
Yeah, that's true. Cool. I think that does conclude the news. Please join us again, though, after this short break. We'll be back to talk about our theme, which this week, what was it again?
I don't remember.
Oh, God. Memory. It's memory. Yeah, please join us again after this short break. Welcome back, listeners. So we are here to talk about memory. To open up this topic, we have Nick.
Hello, Nick. I'm so glad that you said open us up, because something that the thing I want to talk about is really good at. So I looked at bears, and You guys have made fun of me in the past for thinking like, oh, I want to know about this specific thing and how they do their topic of the week. Well, I decided to look up bear memory. And let me tell you, that was a hard search to parse through because people really are into getting sentimental teddy bears. I don't know why, but gosh, it is. I had to go through many pages of Google to find what I was looking for. And I'm glad that I did, because when I got there, it was pretty interesting. So grizzly bears, one of the coolest bears, not to pick sides, but again, with like the spiders, I think grizzly bears, if they minded, they would do more. So grizzly bears can remember where they encountered food 10 or more years before they encounter it again. So what this means is that basically bears have in their minds a spatial memory map. And when they forage, they're omnivores, so they eat pretty much everything. And they can remember where they've come and gone. And even if they leave an area and come back many years later, they can go back to the same place as they found food the first time. So this plays in, especially when bears and humans interact. And if bears, for example, find that they can get food in a certain dumpster in a town or in the outskirts of a city or in someone's backyard, then they'll remember that. And once a bear has had an interaction with a human environment where they can get food, they'll keep coming back again and again to check if there's still food there. The way that this memory system works is they do training. They're constantly inventorying. They're constantly making an inventory of their surroundings and compiling like a detailed map of their territories and where to find their preferred foods and where they can get them. And you might think, well, is this an innate quality? Is this something that they learn? But if you think of bears, one of the things that comes up in our danger training on bears is not to get between a bear cub and its mom. And this comes up often because usually cubs and moms are together. They spend several years together after they're born. And during that time, the mom will educate the cubs about what plants are good to eat and where to find them, how to hunt, how to forage, how to open trash cans, all this sort of thing during those several years. So cubs get this like pre-training by mom. According to the research I was looking at, most animal behaviorists that work with bears think that they're one of the smarter of the land mammals, smarter even than dogs. But this sort of thing can cause problems when food sources change drastically from year to year, depending on weather or climate. So bears have to keep in mind like many years worth of, oh, this raspberry bush here or this dumpster there, or there's this salmon stream here that I can go to at this time of year. It's a complex four-dimensional equation that they have to keep in their mind that really I think we should give them a bit more credit. However, not all researchers agree with this idea of bear memory. And I'm just throwing this in sort of as like a, but wait, there's more. And I leave it up to you to figure out what's the truth. But some studies looking at spatial memory in bears, in captive bears, showed that they didn't, that all of their hunting strategies really sort of accumulated in the end to just by chance, finding food by chance, and that they weren't memorizing where food was or not. But I think that captive bears and wild bears probably act a bit differently. And bears might be on this end of the spectrum where they're not always willing to play by what researchers expect them to do. So there may be other things going on there.
Does this mean that Yogi is still smarter than the average bear, or is the average bear smarter than we presumed?
The average bear is smarter than we presumed, but Winnie the Pooh is definitely one of the dumber bears. Sweet, but dumb. Zen master also, but sweet and dumb.
So my news is about animals that behave in a way that if bears did, you would be endlessly terrified. I'm here to talk about crows. And to a lesser extent, magpies. They also came up in my research. But generally, the corvid sort of bracket covers them both. So I'm going to allow it. I'm in charge here. You guys can't stop me. I'll mute you. Yeah, so I was looking at crows. And what really intrigued me was a study which found that crows remember baddies. I think the title of the paper was slightly different, but that's my takeaway. There was a researcher in Seattle who was capturing crows and banding them, and he found that they remembered his face, potentially for years, and the crows around the campus would dive bomb him. And amazingly, he suggests that most of the crows that dive bombed him had never actually been caught by him. So it appears that they were communicating that he was a threat, and then the others remembered he was a threat and were kind of like, it's the threat, get him! And so they did. So he sent out some of his students in masks to agitate crows, because when you're a professor, you can give students work like that. Like, please go out and get attacked by crows. So they did in their masks anonymously. And yeah, they found that the crows would remember this mask and attack anyone wearing that mask. It's been observed in other corvids as well, like magpies. So it is known that ravens, very intelligent birds, will attack people who are bothering their nest. There's a researcher in Seoul, and he was researching magpie nests. So he had to go in and he would sometimes install cameras. But to a magpie's eye, he's bothering the nest. He's a nest botherer. And they don't like that. They do not like that. And so they would bother him and they would dive bomb him and attack. And he noticed that they would attack him even when he wasn't out nest bothering. So they remembered him and they remembered that he was a nest botherer. So they he should clear off. And to get away from them, he thought, aha, well, I'm a human, see? And I've got a brain. I go to a university. I study magpies. And so he gave his cap to his friend, because the friend doesn't know this. The friend's going to get diagonal by magpies. Excellent plan. And so he gave his cap to his friend. He was like, can you wander off? And then I'll be free to, like, nest bother again. But they didn't bother the guy wearing the cap. They just started dive bombing him again. So it appeared they recognized his face. So they can remember people's faces that annoy them, tell their friends about it, and then gang up on you.
Nick, I am glad that bears don't do that. Wow. Yeah. You know, I will say that it sounds in this situation like the crows are, the corvids in general are being, you know, just about this. But yeah, I was attacked by crows once. And I say attacked by crows, I don't mean one crow attacked me. I mean, I was attacked by multiple crows in succession, dive bombed by them. And I had done nothing, I tell you. I had done nothing. I was totally innocent. All of a sudden, I got hit in the back of the head by something and saw a crow fly off. And it had, like, hit me with its feet. And then I was watching it, like, what was that about, dude? And then another one from behind hit me in the back of the head. And then I was, like, in shock, you know, after the second one. But my adrenaline was pumping at this point, and I was, like, a bit afraid because it hurt. And I quickly looked behind me and another one was coming at me and I ducked and it missed me. But then I like hightailed it out of there. But I have to say, I was not a nest botherer. I don't know what I could have possibly been targeted for, but I'm afraid to go back. What if they recognize me? What if they've told their network of crow friends that my face is a bad face? I don't want to be maligned in the crow community. I want to be, I'm a good person to the crows. Maybe I could do more, but so could we all.
Wow, that is scary.
I'm not the only one who is inspired by corvids, or indeed attacked by them. Naomi, you were looking at a different branch of the corvid tree.
Yeah, so initially I wanted to look at some research that people have done looking at memory and cognition in animals. And our understanding of animal cognition has improved drastically over the last maybe decade or so, and how we think about animals and you know what constitutes as memory has improved a lot. But I wanted to bring up a classic experiment looking at memory in scrub jays. So these are a member of the corvid family, as Nick mentioned. It was published in Letters to Nature in 1998, and it was carried out by Clayton and Dixon. And so what they wanted to look at was, at the time, it was thought that recollection of past events and was a very human idea, and the ability to form a memory and think back to past events was something that really only humans could do. But in birds, food storing birds need to be able to remember spatial locations and contents of caches when they stored them. So they did an experiment, because these birds store caches. So they looked at this scrub jay and they carried out an experiment. So I won't go into everything that they did, but I'll try and give a brief overview of what they did to work out how these birds remember and to show that these birds can remember. So they gave them two different types of cache trial experiments. They had two phases of cacheing. So what that means is basically hiding the food that they have. And it was separated by 120 hours, which is 5 days. And so the birds were allowed to recover items from both sides of the tray four hours after the second cacheing phase. So there was two trials that were carried out. So they cached two types of food. One was peanuts and one were waxworms, which are wax moth larvae. There's two trials they'll refer to. One is called the 4-hour trial. And that's when the second thing they were allowed to cache was waxworms, because there was only a 4-hour gap from when they hid them to when they could go find them. The second trial will be called the 124-hour trial, because that was the waxworms were hidden first. So they had to wait 124 hours before they could go and find the waxworms in that trial. So this means that the waxworms were still fresh on the 4-hour trial. And because these are the preferred food, they would expect the birds to preferentially look for those. And that is what they found. But in the other trial, the one where they had to wait 124 hours, the worms would have decayed at this point. So in this trial, they would expect the birds to go towards the peanuts. And this is also what they found. So they had actually previously trained the birds to show them that the worms would decay after 124 hours, and they did this by having different groups of birds. But what this shows is that the birds were able to remember not only where the worms were stored, but they were also able to remember when the worms were stored. So they were able to remember the relative time between caching and recovery. And so they were able to choose between the peanuts and the worms, depending on how long a time they had to wait. So this is a really interesting piece of research, and it shows that they can know what they hid, where they hid it, and when they hid it. So it shows that they're able to recall and remember what they did. There's also been similar experiments carried out on this sort of memory in other animals. Like, they've done it in rats and different things and in different trials, but I thought this was kind of a cool experiment that started off this sort of thinking.
I hate that all of my research into this is, I would say, one of the most important thing in my life is my house keys, because they are my shelter and it's where all my food is kept. So I should know where my house keys are. But I feel like if you took me out of my bedroom for 124 hours and then were like, where are your keys? I have no idea. I barely know where they are in the morning. Like, and I feel like,
they're in somewhere that we put them, I think, in the, you know, we put them where they're in the same place every day.
Oh, no, I'm a leaver, not a putter.
Oh, you're a leaver, not a putter. Oh,
yeah.
I don't know if we can, I might have to, guys, I gotta go.
So you're obviously a putter. Your keys are where you put them. My keys are where I left them. What about you, gnomes?
So I don't know how to define this, because I have my keys in my bag. I leave them in my bag. But also, if they're not in my bag, I'll put them in my bag. So I don't know whether that counts as being a leaver or a putter. I think a putter, because I know where they are. But
do you know where your bag is at all times? Is your bag where you put it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Putter.
Double
putter.
So my bag is where I left it.
Nick, you could send me to a different country, call me and say, where do I put your bag? Where do I put your, and anything that's out in my room, you ask me where it goes and I'll tell you in words where it goes in my room. I'm a putter. I wonder what blue jays are.
Yeah, I think a putter, because they hid the things.
Okay, yeah.
But also, actually, you guys reminded me, something they did, so that when they were training the birds, they left the cache undisturbed. But when they were doing the actual trial, they took out the worms and the peanut. They replaced the sand so they couldn't actually get any visual or like smell cues from them. It was just based on memory.
Wow.
Mm, yeah.
So I often feel like my brain is mush, as evidenced by my inability to know where any of my stuff is.
You're a leaver, not a putter. It's fine. It's not a, there's no, just for our listeners' sake, there's no moral quality judgment there. It's just who we are, different people.
Yeah. I mean, if you guys wanted to like give you an example, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different things on my desk. And you're logical. I can see your brains are going like, Nick, well, obviously you have logical things on your desk because I'm a logical human being, because I know your desk is probably like immaculate. I bet that doesn't include 3 empty Coke bottles.
They have a place. There's a place for them. The recycling.
Four bin. Satsumas in a bag.
Okay. Fruit bowl.
An empty chocolate wrapper. And a book.
A book on the shelf.
Oh, and some masking tape when I mask things.
That has a box in a drawer.
So yeah, my brain is mush, and as a result, I can't remember anything. But I've learned in my research that is absolutely no excuse. Because I think we spoke about this previously, but there is an amazing animal which turns its brain to mush and still remembers crucial details. So the process of metamorphosis is an amazing one. One that we don't really undergo. I mean, some people do in a minor way, but not in sort of the grand way that insects do. So insects start as a larva or a pupa or a caterpillar, and they evolve into a beautiful fly, a beetle, or butterfly, or moth. And that's what I want to look at today, is memories from the larval stage, which are carried through to the adult stage. Previously, what they thought would happen when a caterpillar metamorphosizes into a moth, essentially inside the cocoon, all of the proteins of the caterpillar essentially become a soup. And this soup is then reformed entirely, basically into a new animal, the moth. So any sort of brain structure would disappear in that because they've got to build like wings and stuff. So how do you store memories if you completely lose brain structure? But one researcher did some amazing thing where when the caterpillars encountered a smell and they used nail polish remover, is that acetate? Is that what it's called?
Acetone.
Acetone. And they paired that acetone with electric shocks, mild electric shocks. They weren't cooking caterpillars. They were just shocking them. And then the butterflies were presented with a Y-shaped tube with an option for food. Down one of them was the smell of acetone. And down the other one was no smell at all. The moths were presented with a choice. What they found is the moths, which as caterpillars had been exposed to the electric shocks when combined, when they were introduced to acetone, would always, or more often than not, choose the tube with no smell. Whereas the moths, which didn't have that experience, didn't have a preference and would just sort of go for the food, which suggests they keep their memories from when they were a caterpillar, which means that our understanding of the metamorphosis process is not fully understood, that some structures of the brain must be kept because these are the parts of that would hold that memory. And so how do they keep the structures of the brain when everything just looks like a soup? And how does it get rebuilt back into the right place? And these are all questions we don't have the answer to. But outside of, I think it was fruit flies as well, are the only other thing that have been observed to carry memories from their larval stage to their adult stage. But yeah, so it proves that no matter how much you destroy your brain, you should be able to remember what gives you electric shocks.
Or where your keys were left.
Yeah. Now that's interesting, but the next topic you want to talk about, I think this animal, there's quite a few interesting points on it.
There are, that's a good one, Nick. That's good. So yes, let me preface by saying this is a story of failure, my own failure, to find a topic about memory. But the journey there to that failure is an interesting one that does touch on memory. So I'm bringing it to our podcast today on memory. Can I say on memory one more time? We'll find out. So I want to talk about starfish, which I think we've mentioned before as one, again, the taxonomist's failure. Neither a star nor a fish. Sea star is a little closer. But yes, they have many points and they lack a centralized brain. So my question, I didn't search starfish memory. What I was wondering is I was thinking about starfish regeneration. So you may know that if a starfish loses an arm, it can grow the arm back. This is called unidirectional regeneration. So they've lost the arm. The central disc of the starfish or the sea star can regrow that arm in one direction, can go, but the lost arm dies. That's many starfish, most starfish. In many starfish, they have what's called disc-dependent bidirectional regeneration. And if they lose their arm and that arm that was lost has part of the central disc in it, the central disc can regrow and regrow an entire starfish from that lost arm, as long as it has a part of the central disc. So then you have two starfish with the same DNA. There's an even smaller subset of starfish that have disc-independent bidirectional regeneration, which means that in these rare cases, the detached limb of a starfish with no remnants of the central disc can regenerate a full starfish just from the limb. Without the mouth or the digestive system that's embedded in the central disc, the detached arm survives on the nutrients stored within it until it can regenerate the disc itself and create the feeding apparatus again so that it can start feeding the arm and then regrow the other arms. Without the ability to feed during recovery, this early stage of recovery, it's very difficult to do this sort of independent, disc-independent bidirectional regeneration. But it does happen, particularly in the Lynchia species of starfish. So this is the sort of like wormhole I got sucked down trying to figure out the answer to my question, which was, do starfish that are regenerated from the arm of the first starfish have the same memories as the first starfish, the original starfish, the Ur starfish, if you will? And there's not a clear answer to this. And that stems from an interesting lack of knowledge in the field on memory in starfish. There doesn't really seem to be that clear of research. And maybe someone who's a starfish, starfish neurological expert would look at me and say, fool, don't you know that something? So I'm not a starfish expert, but what I understand is they lack a centralized brain. They have a complex nervous system, though, with a nerve ring around the mouth, the central disc, and a radial nerve running along each region of each arm. Running along the regions of each arm where they move and sense. And it runs parallel to this sort of radial symmetry, the canal of radial symmetry. The peripheral nerves, so there's the outside and the inner. The peripheral nerves, the outside, has two nets of nerves, a sensory system in the epidermis, and the motor system of nerves that line the sort of inner cavity. And that is what does the moving, and the outer system does the sensing. Neurons connect the two. So it's sort of like within each arm, they have like the connection between the sensory and the motor happening throughout the entire arm, unlike in us, where the sensory and the motor are both in our separate regions of our brain and have to receive information from our extremities, process it, connect it to the motor, and then respond. So everything's happening in the centralized location of our brains, but in the starfish, it can happen in the arm, which I think is the first sort of hurdle to trying to understand memory in a starfish. And I don't know if either of you have read the book Other Minds, which is about the mollusks and particularly about cognition and consciousness in octopus, which is a super cool book. I definitely recommend it to any of you listening today. But it doesn't really talk about starfish. And maybe starfish they're sort of more in the realm of like jellyfish, where we don't think that they have a really clear sense of like purpose or consciousness or memory. But I like to think that these, you know, starfish, what they can do is they can't plan their actions. They can't say like, yes, I found some good sea cucumber over there the other day. Let's go back over there. But what they can do is they can sense food in the environment. And one of their arms can sort of take over control and override the others if it senses odor near it. So if the sort of one arm says, hello, sea cucumber, then all the other arms sort of say, okay. And then they move in that direction towards the sea cucumber. But what I thought was really interesting is that this research, it ended right there by saying the mechanism for this override, this sort of taking over of one arm, isn't fully understood. And it's not clear how it can happen given that the nervous system is decentralized. So I think there's a lot more here to the story. And I think that it's really exciting. This is really what I wanted to take away from this. I really wanted to know whether or not we could have this sort of philosophical discussion about memories. Like when you think about like, if I get duplicated when I get, you know, beamed up by Scotty into the space phaser, do I have the same memories? Am I the same soul? Like this sort of philosophical question we could play out in starfish and let them be our like thought experiments, but in real life. But anyway, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But I do think that there's such a huge amount of information that we don't know about the world around us, and that sort of intertwine these philosophical and biological questions in things as beautiful and interesting as starfish. And that's something that I think as a biologist, and as you know, we do this podcast every week, but I don't often brush up against a feeling of like philosophical wonder. And when I do, I think that's like a moment to pause and sort of think like, this is important. And this is something that we should think about and like, remember, this is why we're interested in the world around us. It's like these questions and not knowing.
It gives me a chance to wheel out my favourite starfish fact as well. That it's the largest order of sea creatures that has no representatives in freshwater.
Whoa. Hmm. What are they doing? There's a whole world out there.
That is so cool, Nick. And I'm really glad that you brought up kind of the philosophical idea of it, and also that you mentioned that maybe you sort of branched away from memory a little bit. I'm glad that you kind of branched away as well, because a similar thing happened to me. So this actually hadn't been what I planned to look up, but I got inspired when I found this researcher when I was looking and I was researching about my news topic. And so this researcher is doing some really interesting work looking at policies in humans and human policies. And what's interesting about this researcher is they're not a human. At Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts, a faculty appointment was made in 2017, and they elected Physarum polycephalum, which, if you remember from the news segment earlier, is a slime mold. So they have a scholar in residence there working in the Cole Science Center. They have a dedicated office. And basically, they have human assistants that help them carry out their work. And what they're looking at...
I love that as a description. They have a human assistant.
Yeah, they have several human research assistants. The slime molds are looking... They're using their problem-solving skills that they've acquired over many millions of years of evolution. And they're tackling policy problems. So these Hampshire students that are helping the slime molds work have been setting up models that work through these policy problems. So, for example, to model the border, there's petri dishes that are divided in half and the resources are unevenly distributed. To model drug policy, the students use valerian root, which slime molds will seek out, even though it could kill them. Yeah, perhaps similar to drug and drug addictions in humans. But this project, on a bigger scale than this, kind of sits at this intersection of science, philosophy, and art. So it was originally... the idea was produced by Jonathan Keats. He describes himself as an experimental philosopher, and he has come up with lots of other of these sort of philosophical experiments that sort of, like I said, bridges gap between art and science. And he wanted to think of it like a thought experiment. So in this way, the slime mold is a challenge for us to consider the logic of other species with advanced intelligence. So say if aliens came down to Earth and they started telling us things about our engineering or how we build things or how we do things, would we listen to them? Like, how would we consider, how do we think about intelligence and other things? And so this is I thought this was a really cool idea that they're, and in a way they're kind of using the absurdity and the humor of it to make a point. And so the slime mold wrote letters to the White House. And at the time that the slime mold was appointed, there was no science advisor in the White House. So they suggested the slime mold could become a science advisor. So yeah, I think it's a really fun idea. So some of the other things this researcher or this experimental philosopher looked at. So he opened up a restaurant for plants where they could have gourmet sunlight. He attempted to genetically engineer God in a laboratory. He made urban camouflage clothing for turtles and choreographed a ballet for honeybees.
It does sound like he has a drug problem, to be fair.
Hey, I love this stuff. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I knew you'd like it. It's this, yeah, I think it's just a really fun intersection, yeah, between science and art and philosophy, so. Also, as well, they mentioned, so the slime mold has its own office. And so you might think that it got demoted because it got put in the basement. But actually, they were being very considerate because slime mold doesn't really like light. Also, at symposiums, they put out wine and cheese for the other researchers, but they leave out some oats for the slime mold.
Oh.
Yeah.
I love this. This is great. I'm, like, thrilled by this.
Yeah, and as far as I can tell, its faculty page is still there, and I think its term was supposed to end in 2019, but I'm not sure if they maybe extended it. But yeah, particularly given what I talked about in the news and that they actually have memories and they are able to solve problems, like they can complete mazes and they can do different simple tasks like that. It's they're a really interesting model to look at this idea of something that's really simple, doesn't have a brain that we can see, but they're still able to do things. And it's not in the way that we do them, but it still gets done. So it's kind of, yeah.
That's amazing. I never thought I would hear that a slime mold has a better job than I do. Actually, I don't know why I'm surprised, to be honest. But that does bring us to an end of our show. Thank you guys so much for all those amazing facts. We will be back next week, where our theme will be all about growth, which is quite interesting. I'm looking forward to that. So I do hope you join us. But until then, listeners, goodbye.
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 Memory. It's memory. Cool.
Memory. Wait, do we have to do copyright for that?
No, but that's definitely going at the end. So, brilliant.